Well, good morning, everyone. Thank you for coming along, getting the day started. My name's Alistair Humphreys, and I've got the enviable task of trying to think of some intelligent-sounding questions for these guys here. We're going to chat for a while about some of the trips we've done, ask them some questions about what wild means to them, and then I'll throw it open to you guys to ask some questions if you would like to. If you feel like yelling out a question anyway through, then that will be great. You can rescue my terrible Paxman-esque interview skills. So I'm Alistair Humphreys. I'm an adventurer and a writer, like all of us are. I've written books about big adventures, and I've written books about small adventures, which I call micro adventures. I'm going to introduce the true stars of the show now from my well-rehearsed notes. This is Phoebe. Phoebe is an award-winning travel editor. She's a writer, she's an author, and her adventures have taken her all around the world, from wild camping on the Scottish Islands to meeting sea gypsies in Burma and watching the northern lights from a heated wigwam above the Arctic Circle. She's also the editor of Wanderlust, which, according to Phoebe's website at least, is the UK's best adventure travel magazine.
Yay!
And she's the author of lots of... How many books now?
Seven?
Yeah. Oh, my. I'm going to have to pull my finger out. Seven books, including Wild Nights, which...
Maybe somewhere.
Somewhere. Probably sold out. So Phoebe is going to be talking a bit about her adventures in the UK. In 2014, she became the first woman to camp at all the extreme points of mainland Britain on consecutive nights. These included the highest, lowest, northernmost, southernmost, easternmost, and westernmost points of the country, also becoming the first person to include the centermost point of Britain in her quest, which is quite intriguing. So we're going to chat to her about that. If you think of any questions, that would be great. Next up is Elsa, who did a pretty epic trip, spending 51 days at sea, solo, rowing in the Pacific Ocean, which is a pretty brutal thing to have done. And she's now written The Wild Guide to Southern and Eastern England, which is the book at the top of the canoe there.
Yeah, done well.
Very, very lovely book. And this is a real change, obviously, from the Pacific. It's a book about local adventures and wild experiences in the crowded Southeast. And there's even a chapter on London. I love the notion of trying to link London plus adventure. We see where she's going with that. And she spent months alternating climbing trees in the New Forest, stumbling into gorgeous country pubs serving mouth-watering local food, tiptoeing around lonely tumble-down churches at dawn, which, in my opinion, sounds a lot better than rowing across the Pacific. On the left, the man with the absurd beard. magnificent beard, it says here. Magnificent beard is Sean Conway. Sean, in 2011, he was miserable, depressed with the life that he'd built for himself. Sean decided to sell his business for £1, and he vowed from that day on to fill his days with experiences rather than things. That decision has changed his life, and it's been an incredible few years for Sean. He has cycled around the world. He has also cycled, run, swam, and sailed the length of Britain. Swimming the length of Britain, very stupid thing to do. Not only has this never been done before, it had never even been attempted. It was going to be one of the hardest swims in the history of swimming. Sean had just 6 months to organize this and plan it. He was constantly laughed at, rejected by sponsors, ignored by people when he wanted advice. He was told it was not only impossible that he was going to die trying. This is a good starting premise for all good adventures. Eventually, after moving in with his mother to save money, classy.
Yeah, on a bunk bed.
Bunk bed.
Top bunk as well.
Top bunk.
Yeah, yeah.
Are you single?
No comment.
That's a yes. Lives with his mum in a bunk bed, heroic adventurer, just like Ranulph Fiennes. He's used his entire life savings to get his boat, left Land's End on the June 2013, took 4.5 months to swim the length of Britain. We're going to talk to Sean about that. That's the subject of his book called...
The one you can't see at the bottom.
Hell and High Water. Also, it's probably sold out. It's actually Swimming books sound really boring, I think. But his book is really, really good. So if you think it sounds a bit boring, you should buy it because you'll be surprised. It's a really good book. After 135 days at sea, Sean swam the last 100 metres into John O'Groats Harbour and the arms of his beautiful mother, I think.
Yeah.
Right. So I'm going to start with Phoebe. The extreme points of Britain.
Yes.
That is a lot of miles, a lot of service station pasties, a lot of driving to go camping.
Yes.
Why did you do that?
I guess that's always the main question before you do any adventure is the why. I don't know. I love wild camping. I love sleeping in wild places. And by the very nature of doing that, I always try and find very remote points of Britain. And I thought, why not do a bit of a like challenge myself, but use my special skill? And my special skill is sleeping. It's really easy. Anyone here can go and sleep wherever they want. So I like to do something that everyone can do. And I thought, let's do something a little bit absurd. I'll go and sleep at the extreme point. So I headed off. The only time I could fit into my full-time job was to go at the end of November, so the weather was not the best. And I got started on Ben Nevis, and it was freezing cold, freezing fog came in. And I didn't think I was going to be able to make it. I had to call it off that night. But then I ended up going around and doing it, and I had a great time. It took me to some places I never normally would have gone to wild camp. So it got me to discover the parts of Britain that I normally wouldn't have done. And I also slept in one of the most unglamorous places I ever had in my life, which was the easternmost point of Britain, which, for those of you who don't know, it's in Lowestoft Ness. And the town itself is fine, but trying to sleep at the easternmost point basically means sleeping between a bird's eye factory and a septic interceptor. So it's not the most glamorous sleep I've ever had, but, you know, in the morning and the sun breaking over the sea, it was glorious. So I think it's just changing your perception on places you have a preconception about.
Sleeping somewhere very unglamorous is quite a good demonstration of it doesn't really matter where you go, does it? It's just
going
and having some sort of excuse that gets you out the door to go is important.
Oh, absolutely.
Where is the centremost point of Britain?
It's actually very contested.
I thought it might
it
be.
It is very contested. So if you go to a place called Haltwhistle, they claim to be the centremost point, but they're actually not. And I checked it with Ordnance Survey, and they told me the centremost point of mainland Britain is it's called Whitendale Hanging Stones. It's a very innocuous little lump within sort of acres of bogland in the Forest of Bowland. And they worked it out by basically saying, I love this, it's so Blue Peter. So I said, how did you work out the centremost point? They said, if you cut out the map of mainland Britain, the point where you'd have to put the pin in so that it didn't fall to the wrong way was Whitendale Hanging Stones, which I think was glorious. That's the way I would work stuff out. I hate math, so that, I loved it. So the great thing about Whitendale Hanging Stones is it's within an area which historically was very difficult to get to because access rights were really, really bad in the Forest of Bowland. It was legendary. You'd be approached by, you know, they're sort of gamekeepers holding shotguns. You couldn't go and walk there even. And it was so remote that in the Second World War, one of the cottages up there was reportedly the last place to know that the war was over.
Really?
It was so hard to get into. So I love the history behind the place anyway. And to be able to walk and sleep somewhere that you're not really supposed to do just added that extra sort of edge for me. Plus, I'd rather sleep there than in the middle of Haltwhistle, with all due respect to Haltwhistle. Okay.
So of all the wild nights that you covered for this book, which was your favourite and why?
Oh, that's a tricky one. I think it was the westernmost point, which was on, and I apologise if you're Scottish and I'm saying any of these names wrong, it was on a tiny hillock called Corridarach Moor on the Ardamurchan Peninsula. And I never would have gone to that point because I'm guilty of being a bit of a hill snob and going for the high mountains with the epic views. And this is a tiny little hillock, but it's so beautiful. You have the view of the lighthouse on the end of the peninsula. You can see over to some of the Inner Hebridean Islands. And it was the most peaceful night's sleep I've ever had. And when I woke up in the morning to have the sea there and then behind me the mountains, I will definitely be going back there.
Cool. Thank you, Phoebe.
Thanks.
Right. 51 days in the Pacific.
Yep.
And then you write a book about local adventures in the southeast. Why? They're pretty different things. Yeah. Why the change?
I started writing it only a few weeks after I got back from the Pacific, so it was quite a change. I'd already been speaking to the publisher about writing that, so we'd kind of been thinking about it, but I'd already planned the Pacific, so I was sort of off doing that. The Pacific voyage was actually cut short, so it was quite lucky because it meant that when I was back, I could get involved with the book.
Okay.
I think probably I wouldn't have been able to if I'd have been out for a lot longer.
Okay.
Because we need to get
writing. Wild plus southeast of England, to many people, doesn't seem to register, particularly when you look around at all the properly wild places around today. So give us a pitch for the wilderness of southeastern England and tell us a bit about that.
Well, I think partly it's sort of adapting your idea of what wild is and how far you want to travel to get to places. And partly there are some really wild places. It's sort of some of the most wooded, well, the most wooded counties in England are in the southeast. You've got amazing cliffs and really empty islands up in the east, places where you can go canoeing and swimming and camping. But also, I think it's so easy to get to if you're in London or around the southeast that you can sort of go for maybe just a couple of stops on a tube and have a mini wild adventure, or an hour out of London and go and sleep the night and swim in a river. So I think I love the big wild places as well, but there are so many places in the southeast that are really worth going to try out if you're not into travelling a lot or if you've only got an afternoon.
Okay. So give us a couple of gems then for all of these people here who are too tight to actually buy your book. Give us a couple of gems of proper wilderness close to London. What were some of the surprises,
proper,
I suppose?
Proper wilderness close to London.
Or surprise. I think in my exploration around southeast England, the bits that I really treasure are the bits that surprise me. So what's some surprises that you found?
The Isle of Sheppey, which doesn't sound particularly wild and romantic. There's quite a lot of entries in the book for that, both for swimming and for sleeping places and for nature as well. There's some amazing birds to be seen there. It's the only place you can sort of legitimately spend the night in a national nature reserve, in a little shepherd's hut there. There's a nudist beach, if anyone's into that. But then also a couple of places in London, just some of the big cemeteries, which is quite huge amount of wild space in there to go and wander around if you've just got an hour, or going and hopping over the wall of the Thames and find when the tide's down and sort of finding a beach to go and have a picnic on. I spent a very happy afternoon there with a friend once.
Fantastic. Is your book or is your preference when you're doing these things, is it about the actual place that you get to, or are you interested in the journeying towards them? And if so, is it about walking, cycling, running, swimming, kayaking, or just none of those things?
I think the book is more about the places, with suggestions for getting there, and I think always better to be cycling, walking, and swimming, kayaking, running, paddleboarding, etc. if you can. I'm quite interested in the journey towards the places. And I imagine I might be writing more about that side of things at some point. But I think also being able to travel between the places. So in the book, there are lots of different places, and some of them are quite close to each other. So working out a way of being able to go for a nice meal, picnic here and do some foraging, hop in the river and swim down to somewhere where it's great to have bivvy in the night, and then get up in the morning and run back up. So kind of, making them meet each other as well.
Okay, cool. Thank you. Sean.
Alistair.
Ugly man with beard at the end.
Another ginger on this panel.
Yes.
Phoebe's the only one.
You know,
I'm representing the other two. Mine's fake.
Sean, you grew up in Africa.
I did,
you've
yes.
You've travelled to lots of different countries in the world. You've cycled around the world. Why then have you spent the last few years exploring boring little Britain?
Oh, that's such an awesome island, you know. My love for sort of Britain started in 2008 when I was trying to go on a holiday, and it's going online like everyone does and going on sort of cheap flights.co.uk and didn't really have any money to go abroad. And then my friend at the time, my flatmate, said, Sean, have you been to the Lake District? And I was like, no. Have you been to the Peaks? No. Scotland? Not outside Edinburgh. And it was an embarrassingly long list of the places I hadn't been to. So I went on eBay, bought a bike for £300, took the train down to Land's End, and jumped on the bike and decided to just cycle up to John O'Groats, because it was the first time I'd heard about this thing called Land's End to John O'Groats, which is such a famous route. It's been done a million different ways. We have a mutual friend who skateboarded it. Someone pushed a bed up it in November. It was amazing. In their pajamas as well. I wonder if they slept in it, actually. Anyway, I need to look into it. It's such an iconic route, and I'd heard about this route, so it fascinated. It captured my imagination. So I jumped on the bike. 25 days later, I landed up in John O'Groats. The record is 44 hours. So that's how rubbish I was at cycling. But it certainly sort of fueled that adventurous spirit. That, I mean, there were places in the UK, I'd put photos up at the time, and people didn't really know where I was. They thought I was in Alaska or something. Then the years went by, and I did a few more things here and there, got caught up back in the rat race of London. Then sort of I failed in an attempt to cycle around the world the fastest. I was trying to break Mark Beaumont's record, but got run over, fractured my back, and all this. And got back to the UK and, you know, got classic adventure blues for a year, going, oh, what should I do? What should I do? I had a broken back. I had no money. Back with, on the bunk bed with mum. Top bunk, bad idea. You know,
with your mum.
Whoa. Someone's got that on record now.
Yes.
Soundbite. I was looking for something else to do, and I sort of thought back, like, Sean, when were you last happiest? When was the last thing? Like, the round-the-world cycle, because I was trying to break the record, is pretty miserable, you know. I was up at 3:20 in the morning. I was cycling through till about 10 o'clock at night, 200 miles a day. It wasn't super fun. It's what I wanted, but it wasn't exciting. And I thought back, oh, cycling the length of Britain, that was fun. Why don't I try and do another version of those? And then, I don't know how I came across the swimming idea, but I eventually kind of thought, well, that could be cool. Let me find out who's done it, and I'll be the fastest person to swim Land's End John O'Groats. And it soon became clear, I put some things online, that no one had even attempted it, which was worrying. except one chap put a swimming pool on the back of a van and did lengths as they drove it, which I thought was amazing. Such a British thing to do. And so besides this guy, who was going to be pretty useless in information, there was no one had even tried it. I thought, right, nothing suggested the swim was impossible. There wasn't going to be counter tides. It was just going to be long and miserable. So I put things online, but it soon became pretty clear that the overall kind of idea was that the swim was impossible, and a little kid from Zimbabwe couldn't do it either. I think that kind of fueled it as well, but it did make things quite difficult trying to get to the start. Again, just exploring a different version of the UK, you know. I'd done all the roads, and then the swim is all about the ocean, so...
So how long did you think the swim was going to take on day one, and how long did it take?
Well, on the advert for crew, it read, all expenses paid, summer vacation up the British Isles. Little did they know we'd still be in Scotland in November, 4.5 months later. I thought it would take about 2.5 months, but I had no idea about the waves, the weather, the tide. Trying to anchor the small boat that we had safely was taking forever. I was swimming about 3 miles offshore. I didn't realize 26-foot yachts only do about 2.5 miles an hour. So, you know, the round trip from finishing swimming each session to an anchorage and back, in Scotland especially, was 6 hours. You know, so all these things just added loads and loads of time. And I'm a rubbish swimmer. So.
And that was it. Tell us about that. That was the beginning of the famous beard. Tell us. I mean, obviously, it's for your good looks now.
Yeah, of course, it is. Yeah,
why
definitely.
Did the beard begin?
Well, it was probably on the when I decided cleverly in the pub to swim across to Ireland because it seemed like a cool idea. I just crossed the big Irish shipping lanes and feeling really confident that I was going to reach Ireland. All of a sudden, swam dead face into a lion's mane jellyfish, and the tentacles went up my nose and in my mouth and everywhere. And that was about as fun as it sounds. Also, does anyone know how you fix jellyfish stings? There's a myth. Anyone? You pee on it. I'm telling you right now, that does not work. Very embarrassing, considering I got stung on the face. But we can move on. Anyway, I soon realized after a week or two, I had a little bit of facial hair, and it was physically stopping the tentacles touching my skin. So I thought, from that day on, I'm just going to grow this massive beard. Ironically, it made me look more like a lion's mane jellyfish, so they're probably just coming over to have a chat.
Cool. There's a really beautiful fell running film. I don't know if any of you have seen it. It's called Of Fells and Men. It's only about 7 minutes, really beautiful. And at the end of that, there's a phrase that really stuck in my mind, which is the protagonist has been going all over the world, running and running and running, and then he comes to the Lake District and he finds these runners who've just been running in the Lake District for their whole life. And he finds that he's jealous of them for really focusing on one place. And in it, he says, one mountain range is enough for anyone in a lifetime. And I love that notion of really exploring one place. And I think that's what you've done really well with your Land's End John O'Groats by foot, by sailing, swimming, and running.
Right,
So give us very briefly, which isn't your speciality, one advantage and one disadvantage of each of the methods of doing Land's End John O'Groats.
Cycling advantage is it's easy, anyone can do it. Disadvantage, it's slightly less rewarding, I think. The easier it is, potential heights, you call it type 2 fun. If it's easier, it's less rewarding. If it's harder, it's more rewarding. The swimming, there's no benefits to that, honestly. It's rubbish.
You got a book.
The book's great. There we go. You can just buy the book and then... I got quite fit, I guess, on the swim. Running, you can do the trails. You don't have to stick to roads. And there's an amazing network of trails in the UK. Just get Ordnance Survey maps, you'll see how many there are, which is awesome. The sailing, I broke the sailing record a few months ago. 84 hours it took. I was seasick for 50 of them. So that wasn't much fun either. I just love the ocean. I live on an old World War II boat, so I love everything to do with water and the ocean. So I got one more to do in August. By air.
By air?
Yeah, watch this space.
Ooh, fantastic. Paramotoring, or is this top secret?
It's top secret for
okay.
now.
Yeah. Top secret, probably paramotoring. I think that people often ask me when they're trying to come up is the idea of coming up with ideas and where to go and what to do and things. So I'm just going to ask all three of you if you could offer some advice about if you're trying to think of a way to go explore the UK, where should people go, and... a little bit about the sort of practicalities and legalities of that. Who wants to go first on that?
I'll go, why not? So I suppose the most common question I'm asked, given that I like to go and spend at least one night in these places, is it legal to wild camp? And the answer is, it is in Scotland and it is in Dartmoor because of an old bylaw, but the rest of the UK you're technically supposed to ask the landowner's permission. However, this is wildly impractical. One, because you can't always find the landowner. Two, because you can't even always find out who the landowner is. So I've been doing it for sort of over 10 years now. I've never been told off or asked to move on just because, you follow the sort of unwritten, that has been written about by me mainly, code of wild camping, which is to, arrive late, leave early, take all your rubbish out with you and, just... find somewhere that's obviously not too obvious to everyone and just sneak yourself in there. And it's a really rewarding thing to do, I think. And obviously, I'll shamelessly plug all our books, that I think your micro-adventures is really good for inspiring people on sort of mini-adventures they can fit in with their lives. I've also done one called Wilderness Weekends, which has got 26 ready set adventures where you can sort of go follow. And obviously, we've got the Wild Guide. And then... Yeah. For Sean, people who want to cycle Land's End John O'Groats, I'm sure there's lots of nuggets in there to do it. And swimming if they feel up to the challenge.
I think just on the legality side of wild camping in Britain, it's amazing how hung up people get about this issue, given that probably every single person who asks the question drives at 35 miles an hour in a 30 area, which is a far more bad thing to do. I think as long as you... smile a lot and are polite and don't leave any mess, no one ever minds, and it's always easier to seek forgiveness than permission in life. So I think the legality of wild camping really people overplay this, I think. I think generally if you're polite and friendly, people just think you're... Well, nearly always no one sees you, but if they do, they're just curious, really.
Yeah. Although just to add to that, actually, I mean, usually I follow that advice, but there have been times when I have asked a farmer or something where it seems sensible to go and ask, and I've generally ended up with a really nice breakfast in the morning for free. So people are really friendly normally, and I've never had anyone say no.
Could you give us some practical ideas then about how... Because I think when you're certainly in a big city of London, it's quite hard to imagine that somewhere out there are fields and countryside. How do you go about finding wild places in the crowded southeast of England?
Well, again, it depends what you mean by wild.
What do you mean by wild?
Well, anything really, anything with some trees or water or a bit of grass. But I mean, in terms of sleeping, pretty much anywhere you can go and sleep.
It can sort of tuck yourself.
And particularly if you're in a bivy bag, you can be really hidden. Just get sort of tuck under the hedge or around a corner, wait till it gets a bit dark. Anywhere's okay. You can hop on a train. I guess I'd look at maps, actually. Okay. I really like maps. So looking at an Ordnance Survey map, look for the green bits. And then sort of maybe zoom in, have a look at what they are. If there's a sensible way to get there, if there's a river nearby you want to go for a swim in. But then kind of especially along the coast, I can think of lots of places where I've had fires and slept and everything, and no problem at all.
And perhaps you two could offer some comments on being a woman and getting out wilderness adventures as a woman. I often get asked about this. People say, oh, it's great you going to do this stuff. What about women doing it? What are your thoughts?
I think we're the same as you at the end of the day. And I think people often do come up to me at the end of a talk I do and say, I can't believe you go and do this on your own. You're a woman. And it's like, well, so what? It doesn't make any difference. And I think for me, the great outdoors is the ultimate leveler. I mean, you know, the mountains, the rivers, the rocks, they don't care whether you're a man or a woman, whether you're old, young, fat, thin, they don't care anything about you. They're just there. So if you go out there and just don't even think about what you are, just go and enjoy it for what it is.
Yeah, I think different people feel different levels of concern about that. I've got a friend who wild camps loads, but she always likes to... be quite discreet about it because she just doesn't like the idea of someone seeing her and following her to somewhere. So she always packs really small bags so it looks like she couldn't be out sleeping. But then, I mean, I hitch a lot. So actually that's another way that I like to get to places. And I get asked about that quite a lot, about the sort of safety of that as a woman. I found it to be an advantage because I get more lifts.
Yes.
Never felt unsafe at all. Ever.
I think more than anything as a woman, I worry about the opposite of some well-meaning person. And it happens if they see you heading up a mountain as it's going dark, they try and help you and they go, oh, did you want to lift here? Shall we come with you? Shall we do? And you're like, actually, I just want to be by myself.
Fine.
Yeah, I'm fine. I know what I'm doing. It's fine. But I think it's that the first time you do it, and I'm sure you agree, is the first time is the most sort of terrifying away, but that happens to anyone, whether you're a man or a woman.
Yeah.
I'd say more men than women actually come up to me after a talk and go, I'm really inspired to do it now. Can you tell? You know, they're almost embarrassed about it. It really is that simple. And you talk about this as well a lot. And so, you know, anyone can do it. You just... what my top tip really is, I keep a bag, a ready-made bag that I call my go bag, by the front door or in the boot of my car with all my kit packed, ready to go and sleep somewhere or go have a walk. And then you've never got an excuse. You know, if the weather looks good, you know, you've finished what you need to do at work or whatever, you just think, right, I'm just going to go. And I think it's that excuses. There's always a reason not to do it, but you should just do it.
And I think if you're nervous as well, go with a friend first time. And
absolutely.
Yeah.
And Sean, do people worry about you out in
generally
the wild?
For other reasons.
Or are they usually scared of you?
Scared of me, generally. What's the difference between camping and sleeping rough? There we go. I just say I'm sleeping rough.
Okay, yes.
You look kind of homeless anyway.
Yes. I've got a couple other questions, but I think I'll throw it open now while we've got time, if any of you guys got any questions you want to ask of any of our panelists. Any questions? Yes, very brave lady there with a question.
Run, Forrest.
Okay. You guys obviously all started out just having adventures and enjoying them. What was the process to then be writing and published and sharing them with other people?
That was meant to be my next question.
I've got really good eyesight.
If no one else had any things. Okay. Far away, Sean.
It all just happened by mistake. I guess Dave and Elle sort of gave me some advice after I finished cycling around the world when I was kind of thinking, oh, should I write about it? Dave's books, Elle's books are going to be better than mine anyway. Should I bother? And Dave gave me a best piece of advice. He said, don't write the book for anyone else. Write it for your future grandkids because your memories will eventually fade. And I suddenly thought, you know what? I have no memories or of my grandparents and no stories from them. They died before I was old enough to have a proper conversation with them. And I think that was the start. Write it for yourself. And when it's there, you can upload it to Kindle for nothing. It takes 48 hours for them to approve it. And all of a sudden, it's there for the world. But I think inherently, write it for yourself. Hmm. And Hemingway famously only wrote 500 words a day, which he would do by 8 a.m. and then drink a lot of whiskey, apparently. So you don't have to sort of take weeks off. Just every night, put an hour aside and just get writing.
Cool. I mean, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I have a full-time, very stressful job, and I managed to write my 7 books at the same time of having a full-time job and going out and doing all these wild sleeps. I think I agree with Sean, you should write it because you want to write it, and I think you should definitely write about what you know and what you're passionate about, because that really comes through in the words. I think you've also got to think about if there is anyone, it depends what you're doing it for. If you're writing it for yourself, just write it for yourself. If you want people to hopefully buy it and get something from it, you've got to sort of look out there and think what else is out there and what you want people to take from your book. You know, is it an inspirational message? Is it that you want them to follow in your footsteps? You know, what do you want to give to the world in that story? And then is there a market to do that? And then, you know, can you do what Sean does? You know, just publish it yourself and see what happens. Or do you want to go sort of the other way and see if you can get an agent or a publisher to sort of accept it?
I think also particularly if you're doing things by yourself, it's a really nice way of sharing that. Because when you're out by yourself, you haven't got anyone to talk to about it. Maybe you're writing in your notebook or writing a blog when you get back and sort of building that up really. And having a chance to share those adventures that you weren't talking about to anyone at the time.
I find coming to this show really interesting because I used to come here before I'd been on any adventures. I used to go around and get loads of brochures and go home and daydream about all these adventures that I might one day have. And I used to come to talks like this thinking, oh, I'd love to write a book. And I find it really interesting now to be here having been on some adventures and written a book. And the way it happened for me was, the first thing was I went and did a massive adventure just because I wanted to do it and it felt important to me. I didn't really think about careers or anything then. It was just something that felt important to me. I came home and wrote the book, similar to Sean said, just because it felt important to me. No one wanted to publish it, so I self-published it. The world is so meritocratic now for publishing. Any one of us can publish a book tomorrow. You press go. If it's good enough, people will gradually start to buy it, and gradually, in my case, I've started to turn writing and adventure into my job. But the key thing to do is to do a big trip because you want to, and then write a book because you care about it, I think.
And I think not expect it to happen overnight, isn't it? It's like you said, it's that it is hard work and it does take time, but if it's something, again, that you're passionate about, that's eventually, and if you enjoy what you're doing anyway, it doesn't really matter how successful it is.
Any other questions?
Because you've all been to such amazing and beautiful places, is there anywhere you would never go back to again?
Places we'd never go back to again. Ooh. I'm not very interested in going back to places, and that's not really for a negative reason. It's more just that there are so many places I haven't yet been to. There's more than half the countries in the world I still haven't been to, so I'm more drawn to going to places. And also, when I do go back to places, there's always the risk of the original memory you have isn't quite as sweet the second time, so I'm much keener on going to new places.
Yeah, ditto.
Ditto. That's a good answer, Sean. This is a good conversation. Thanks, Sean.
I think never say never. Okay. Is my thing, because you can go back to somewhere in a different season, a different time of your life that you might appreciate it differently, or under different circumstances. So I've been tempted with places to say never again, but then ended up going back in the line of work and absolutely loved it and seen it from a different way. So I never say never.
Ditto as well.
Marvellous, thank you.
We're on it.
Are you going to go back to the Pacific Ocean?
Possibly. We're not sure.
Okay.
Can I ask, I'm quite intrigued, just to sort of round everything off by knowing 2 minutes on each of you of what you found, you might have found, is your worst or most embarrassing travel experience. Something that you've absolutely cringed about that maybe you've not mentioned or dared to self-publish before, but that you could spill to us today.
That's appropriate for an 11 o'clock audience at a family show. Sean, bear that in mind.
Yeah, actually. I once really needed the loo in the middle of the Atacama Desert and had run out of toilet paper, so spent an hour looking for some newspaper that someone had thrown out the window. Eventually, on the brink of a major disaster, I saw something white about 100 meters in the sand. Now, this is the Atacama, there's nothing but sand. So I ran there, pants around my ankles, got there. It wasn't newspaper, it was the rib cage of a sheep or a dog. So I used three ribs as toilet paper once. There we go. Beat that.
I decided to see if I could cycle naked all the way through a town in Japan. And it turned out that the police in Japan don't approve of that behavior. So I got arrested for that.
I don't know if I've got such good stories. You go.
It's not really embarrassing on the same level of these two.
That's probably a good thing.
I was more embarrassed because when I was living in Canada, I decided to just go on a last-minute holiday, and I went to Cuba before it became as monumentally popular as it does now, and stupidly booked myself onto this all-inclusive resort, which, it's my idea of hell. And I got there, and I absolutely hated it. And so I booked straight away to head out and explore the real Cuba. And then Hurricane Rita came. And I was like confined to my room and had to sleep in the bath in the bathroom I was just really embarrassed to be in that scenario. The one, I booked it for the worst time in the world, and I'm supposed to know about travel, and two, that I was then confined to a all-inclusive resort. So not about poo or nakedness, but still pretty embarrassing.
I don't know really. I think I'm not particularly easily embarrassed. So, but just being on the Pacific, actually having to email pictures of my bottom to the expedition doctor to see if the sores and spots were okay or I had to do anything about them. I think that's probably not unique to me. So.
Any other questions about travels, adventures? Okay, I've got a question for all of you. Whilst I think you should all go and book cruises to Antarctica, etc., whilst you're at this show. If you choose not to do that, and I gave you £200 to go do some sort of adventure in the UK, what would you go and do?
I would go and get myself a berth on the sleeper train up to Scotland, because if you can book far enough in advance, you can get it for about £39. Something so romantic about travelling by train in the night and sleeping and waking up somewhere really wild. And then I have a love, I'm sure they said before I came out, I wrote a book about bothies, which are these remote mountain shelters. And I would do a bothy to bothy adventure, because the great thing about them is they're in sort of wild, remote places, so it's incredible scenery. But also, it's all serendipitous. You can't book them, you don't know who's going to stay there, and so you don't know what's going to happen. I mean, that's true of any adventure, but it's the fact of opening that door and seeing who's there, and you could have it completely to yourself in this wonderful setting you'd never be able to afford to live in, or you could meet some incredible people. I once went into one and crashed a stag party in full flow, and there were a few remarks about me being the stripper who'd arrived, but after they got over that, they were the nicest people ever, and they cleared out a room, so I had my own room, and they gave me a beer, they gave me a seat by the fire, and gave me hot food. And so, you never know what's going to happen. So that for me, and I'd have changed from the £200 for sure.
I've been getting swimming recently. I've always have been a bit, but I've been getting into going through the winter. I've been getting more into the idea of swimming the length of a river. So I think I'd probably find a river in the UK that I wanted to swim and sort of sleep along the way and take my things with me, which would give me a lot of change. So maybe I'd eat really luxuriously on the way.
Mine involves a swim as well. I'd go up to Scotland as well. Scotland's amazing. It's my favourite place in the UK. And I'd swim the length of Loch Ness, dragging everything in a raft, all my camping kit, and my running kit. And when I got to the bottom, I'd pack it all up and run back.
I can definitely second the notion of a sleeper train. If you haven't been on the sleeper train to Scotland, it is one of, I think, the great travel experiences. You get on the train at Euston, you wake up in the mountains of Scotland. It's a magical thing to do. Really recommend it. My question, the problem is £200 is too much money. Yeah. And since I've been doing these quite frugal adventures, micro-adventures, I've realised that you just don't need much money. 200 is just so wildly extravagant for this, but I would be really curious to go and cycle around the coast, see how far I could get living off caviar and see and cycling around the coast of Britain. I'd really like to try that.
I think, yeah, I could imagine, I'm thinking about the food now, kind of eating all the most delicious and expensive local food along the way. Possibly that's the way to use it.
That'd be very nice. Yeah. Any final questions for anyone? You wimps, come on. No? Okay. Well, I'm just going to wrap up. Thank you all very much for coming along. I'm going to give a final plug for some great books. Phoebe's books are full of proper, genuinely useful information. If you're dreaming of some sort of adventures, they're full of really practical stuff. They're also very inspiring. The Extreme Sleeps is really inspiring for getting people to go out and do more. Your book is absolutely beautiful, really, really beautiful for showing that beauty, wilderness, adventure really close to where we are in the southeast of England. So highly recommend it. Sean's book is better than you think it will be. It's actually his book of Swimming Up Britain is really genuinely fantastic book. It's a proper, hardcore, extreme adventure right here in boring little Britain. So I think it's really worth a read. And if you've got any if you have any kids, please buy my kids' books because they're brilliant, I think. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.